A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the actual history of tefillin materials, what the first ones were made from, and specifically whether goat leather was the original choice. He mentions he picked goat leather for his own set, thinking it'd be closer to the ancient practice. Then he wants to know about the different grades on the market today and how long it takes a scribe to write the scrolls inside. Which means we're basically doing a materials science and supply chain episode, not a theology one.
I love this question because it gets at something most people never think about. Your tefillin might be made from an animal that wasn't even the preferred choice 2,000 years ago. The archaeological record on this is actually pretty clear, and it contradicts a lot of what people assume. Most people picture the ancient Near East as this landscape of goats wandering around on rocky hillsides, which it was, and they think, well, obviously that's what they'd use. But the physical evidence tells a completely different story.
Let's start with what tefillin actually are. For anyone who's never handled a pair, you've got two leather boxes, the shell rosh that sits on the head, and the shell yad that goes on the arm. Inside, each are parchment scrolls containing four Torah passages. Exodus 13, verses 1 through 10. Exodus 13, 11 through 16. Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9. And Deuteronomy 11, 13 through 21.
The shel rosh has four separate compartments, each holding one scroll. The shel yad has a single compartment with all four passages written on one continuous strip of parchment. And the boxes themselves, the batim, are made from the hide of a kosher animal, compressed and shaped over a mold, then painted black. The black paint, by the way, is itself a halachic requirement. The boxes must be black, and there are specific rules about how that black is achieved and applied. It's not just an aesthetic choice.
The core question is straightforward. What were the earliest tefillin actually made from, and how does that compare to what's available now?
This is where things get interesting. The oldest physical tefillin we have come from the Qumran Caves, same general area as the Dead Sea Scrolls, dating to around the 1st century BCE. There are also specimens from Rabaat and Nahal Hever from the 2nd century CE, so around the Bar Kokhba period, and here's the key finding. A major study led by Yonatan Adler and the Israel Antiquities Authority, published in 2021, analyzed leather fragments from 22 ancient tefillin using FTIR spectroscopy.
FTI being Fourier Transform Infrared Spectroscopy, basically shooting infrared light at a sample and reading the molecular fingerprint that bounces back. It can identify animal species from degraded leather fragments that are 2,000 years old. Think of it like each species having a unique chemical signature in the collagen proteins that survives even after centuries in a cave.
And what they found is striking. Out of all the samples, not a single one was goat leather. The Qumran tefillin were made from calfskin and sheepskin, which means, if you're going for historical authenticity, goat leather is actually the less authentic choice. You'd be better off with calf, which is funny because calf is what the high-end market already prefers, just for different reasons.
The assumption that goat leather was the original material because goats were common in the ancient Levant, it makes intuitive sense, but it doesn't hold up against the physical evidence. And I think this is a good example of something we see across a lot of ancient technologies. People assume that whatever was most abundant must have been what was used. But craftspeople in the ancient world were perfectly capable of being selective. They didn't just grab whatever animal walked by.
Right. And there's a practical reason for this. Goat leather is thinner and more porous than calfskin. Tefillin boxes need to maintain their structural integrity for decades. They're being handled daily, they're exposed to body heat and sweat, they're being opened for inspection periodically. Goat hide absorbs moisture differently, and over time that can affect the scrolls inside. The parchment in the scrolls is hygroscopic. It absorbs ambient moisture, and if the box isn't providing a stable microclimate, you get warping, cracking, ink degradation.
Can we get more specific about that mechanism? Because I think it's easy to hear moisture and think, okay, don't get them wet, but the daily reality is subtler than that.
Every morning when you put on tefillin, your body heat raises the temperature inside the box by several degrees. Warm air holds more moisture, so the relative humidity inside the compartment shifts. When you take them off, the box cools down, and that moisture can condense slightly on the inner surface. Over hundreds of these cycles, a porous leather-like goat hide acts almost like a sponge. It absorbs that microcondensation and transfers it to the parchment. Calfskin, being denser and less porous, buffers those humidity swings much more effectively. It's essentially a better environmental enclosure. And the ancients would have discovered this through trial and error over generations of use. You make a pair of tefillin from goat, the scrolls inside degrade after a few years, you notice that the ones made from calf last longer, and you adjust your practice accordingly.
The ancients weren't choosing calfskin for religious reasons. They were choosing it because it works better.
That's the material science of it. The Talmud actually discusses acceptable leathers for tefillin in Tractate Shabbat, page 28b, and it doesn't prioritize goat at all. The discussion is about what constitutes a kosher animal hide, not which species is preferred. And Tractate Menashot 34b specifies that the boxes must be from a kosher animal but doesn't name a species. The preference for calf seems to have emerged from practical experience.
If the Talmud doesn't specify calf, where did the idea come from? That goat was somehow the more authentic or original choice?
I think it's a combination of things. Goats feature prominently in biblical narratives. The scapegoat ritual, the goatskin coverings of the tabernacle, the kid goat that was boiled in its mother's milk. There's a cultural association between goats and ancient Israelite practice. Plus, in the modern era, goat leather became associated with certain Hasidic communities who preferred it for Kabbalistic reasons, and that created a perception that it was the older tradition. But the archaeological evidence just doesn't back that up.
Let's talk about the modern material grades, because this is where the market gets complicated. When someone walks into a Judaica store today, what are they actually choosing between?
There are really two separate material decisions. One is the parchment for the scrolls, that's called klaf. The other is the leather for the boxes, that's the batim. For the batim, you've got a hierarchy. At the top, you have what's called batim geso, literally, thick boxes. These are made from full-grain calf leather, multiple layers compressed under enormous pressure. The hide is soaked in lime, scraped, stretched, molded over a wooden form, and then dried under pressure for months. A single pair of geso batim can take 6 to 8 months just for the leather working alone.
6 to 8 months just for the boxes. Walk me through why it takes that long. What's actually happening during those months?
The initial hide preparation, liming, dehairing, fleshing, that's a few weeks. Then you have the stretching and molding phase. The leather is wetted and stretched over a wooden form that has the exact dimensions of the final box. As it dries, it shrinks and conforms to the form. But you can't just do that once and be done. You do it repeatedly. Wet, stretch, dry, remove, re-wet, stretch again. Because each cycle increases the density and rigidity of the leather. For geso batim, you're doing multiple layers. The inner layer is molded first, then the outer layer is stretched over it, and the two are bonded under pressure. Then the whole assembly is dried slowly, sometimes in a controlled environment, to prevent cracking. The black paint is applied in thin coats with drying time between each. If you rush any of these steps, you get delamination, or the paint doesn't bond properly, or the box warps. There's no shortcut.
This is all still done by hand?
There are a few workshops that use hydraulic presses for the compression stage, but the molding, the stretching, the painting, that's all manual. The skills are passed down through apprenticeship. It's one of those crafts where the difference between a master batim maker and an apprentice is visible in the final product. The sharpness of the corners, the uniformity of the black finish, the way the compartments align.
Okay, so that's the top tier. What's below geso?
Below geso, you have batim dakot, thin boxes, which use a single layer of thinner leather, usually calf or sheep, molded but not multi-layered. These take less time to produce and are significantly cheaper. Then at the bottom you have batim peshutim, simple boxes, which are often made from sheep or even reconstituted leather, and these are what you typically find in the $150 to $300 range.
Where does goat leather fit into this modern hierarchy?
Goat leather batim exist, but they're a niche product. Because goat hide is thinner, it's harder to achieve the structural rigidity required for gesot-grade boxes. Most goat leather tefillin fall into the dakot or peshutim categories. You can get well-made goat leather batim, but they won't have the same density and durability as calf gasso. And that's probably why the Qumran tefillin makers preferred calf. They were working with the materials that gave the best long-term results.
Daniel's choice of goat leather, while well-intentioned, was based on an assumption that the archaeological record doesn't support.
I want to be clear, there's nothing wrong with goat leather tefillin. They're perfectly kosher. The Talmud explicitly permits any kosher animal hide. But if the goal was historical authenticity, the evidence points to calfskin as the more ancient choice. What he's got is a perfectly valid ritual object. It's just not the historical reconstruction he thought he was buying.
There's another layer here, which is the kosher certification industry and what I can only describe as the GLAT premium.
Oh, this is a whole economic subculture. The term GLAT technically refers to the smoothness of an animal's lungs after slaughter. It's a specific stringency in kosher meat certification. It has nothing to do with leather. But the kosher certification industry has created a tiered market where mahedron, tefillin, meaning strictly kosher, with every possible stringency observed, command premium prices. And one of the selling points is that the leather comes from animals slaughtered under specific conditions, with the hide processed in a way that's supervised from slaughter to finished product.
Which creates a price spectrum that runs from about $150 to $5,000 or more.
The thing is, much of that price difference isn't about the material at all. It's about the scribal work inside. But the leather quality has become a status marker. People will ask, are your batim gasso? Are they mahadran? Were they made in Beni Brak or Jerusalem? There's a whole geography of prestige around where your tefillin were manufactured.
60% of global production is concentrated in Jerusalem and Beni Brak, right?
The global tefillin market was estimated at about $120 million in 2024, and those two cities dominate production. There are workshops in Jerusalem's Mia Sharim neighborhood that have been making batim for four generations, using tools and techniques that haven't changed much in centuries. The leather is still stretched over wooden forms by hand. The black paint is still applied in multiple thin coats. It's remarkably resistant to automation.
Why hasn't automation penetrated this market? $120 million is big enough that you'd expect someone to figure out how to mass produce, at least the batim.
Partly, it's the halachic requirement of lishma, that the object be made with specific intent for its sacred purpose. A machine can't form intent, but there's also a market dynamic at work. The customer base for premium tefillin is deeply conservative about production methods. If a workshop started using CNC machined molds and automated leather pressing, there would be immediate questions about whether the resulting batim were valid. Even if a rabbinic authority approved it, consumer acceptance would lag by years or decades. So the economic incentive to automate is weaker than it looks, because the market might reject the product regardless of cost savings.
We've established what the ancient tefillin were actually made from, and what the modern material landscape looks like. But the really interesting part, and I think the part that actually determines whether a pair of tefillin is worth what you paid, is what's inside the boxes.
This is where the real craftsmanship lives. A sofer, a scribe, writes the four passages on parchment using a quill and kosher ink. And this process is fundamentally different from writing a Torah scroll, which most people are more familiar with. First, the letter forms are different. Tefillin script requires specific formations of the tagen. Those are the crown-like decorative strokes on certain Hebrew letters. The tagen in tefillin are more elaborate and more strictly prescribed than in a Torah scroll. The sofer uses a reference text called a tikkun soferim that shows the exact form of every letter. If a single letter is cracked, misshapen, or missing a required tag, the entire scroll is invalid.
What's the actual letter count we're talking about?
Approximately 1,200 Hebrew letters across the four passages. That doesn't sound like a lot. 1,200 letters is maybe two pages of typed English. But this isn't typing. Each letter is formed with a quill on parchment, and the sofer must pronounce each word aloud before writing it. You can't go back and fix a mistake by erasing or scraping. If a letter is written incorrectly, in many cases you have to start that section over. And for the shel rosh, each of the four compartments requires its own scroll written on a single strip of parchment. No cutting allowed. If you make a mistake on the third passage of a shel rosh scroll, that entire strip is unusable.
The pressure per stroke is enormous. You're 45 minutes into a scroll, you've got 3 passages perfect, and 1 wrong letter means you scrap the whole thing.
That's not a hypothetical. Sofirm will tell you it happens regularly, especially early in a career. You develop a kind of mental discipline where you're simultaneously focused on the individual letter you're forming and aware of how many letters remain in the passage. It's a specific kind of sustained attention that's hard to describe if you haven't done it. Some Sofirm compare it to a meditative state.
How long does it actually take?
An experienced Sofer can produce 3 to 4 sets of tefillin scrolls per month working full-time. A single set takes between 8 and 12 hours of concentrated writing. But that's for an experienced scribe who's been doing this for years. A newer Sofer might take twice as long, and their error rate is higher, which means more discarded parchment.
The ink itself has constraints that make the work harder.
Right, and this connects to something we explored in depth in our episode on kosher ink chemistry. Tefillin ink must be carbon-based, traditionally lamp black mixed with tree sap or gum arabic as a binder. No metallic compounds. No iron gall ink, which was common in medieval European manuscripts. The reason is halachic. The ink needs to sit on the surface of the parchment, not etch into it. Metallic inks chemically bond with the parchment, which creates a different physical relationship between the ink and the writing surface. Carbon-based ink sits on top and can theoretically be removed, which is actually a halachic requirement even though in practice you're never supposed to remove it.
The ink constraint isn't arbitrary. It's about the physical chemistry of how the ink interacts with the parchment.
And this matters practically because carbon-based ink takes longer to dry, it's more susceptible to smudging, and it requires the sofer to maintain a consistent ink viscosity throughout the writing session. If the ink is too thick, it sits on top and flakes off later. If it's too thin, it bleeds into the parchment fibers and you lose the clean letter edges that are required. The sofer is constantly adjusting their ink mixture based on humidity, temperature, even the specific batch of parchment they're working with.
This sounds like the kind of tacit knowledge that can't really be taught. You have to develop it through years of practice.
That's exactly why top scribes have waiting lists of 6 to 12 months. The market for high-end tefillin is constrained not by demand, but by the supply of skilled labor. There are only so many Sofirim who can produce Mahadran-quality scrolls at a consistent rate, and the certification process adds another layer. The scrolls are checked by a separate expert, a Magaya, who examines every letter under magnification. If the Magaya finds a problem, the scroll goes back to the Sofer for correction, if the error is fixable, or it's discarded entirely if it's not.
What makes an error fixable versus unfixable?
It depends on the type of error and when it's caught. If a letter is missing a required tag, that can sometimes be added afterward. If 2 letters are touching where they shouldn't be, a sofer can carefully separate them with a scalpel. But if a letter is fundamentally misshapen, if a dalet looks like a resh, for example, or if the error is in one of the names of God, which cannot be altered once written, that section is invalid and must be buried in a geniza, a repository for sacred texts.
A dalet versus a resh, for listeners who don't read Hebrew, these are 2 letters that look almost identical. The dalet has a small projection at the upper right corner, and the resh is smoothly rounded. If that projection is too small, or if the ink is spread slightly, you've got a resh where a dalet should be, and the entire word is changed.
Right, and this isn't a theoretical concern. The Hebrew word eked, one, as in "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one," is written with a dalet at the end. If that dalet looks like a resh, the word becomes aker, other, or strange. You've just written, "The Lord is strange," in your tefillin. That's the level of precision required. A fraction of a millimeter on one letter changes the meaning of the most important declaration in Jewish liturgy.
That's a lot of pressure.
And it's why the Magaya's role is so important. The sofer has been staring at these letters for hours. They know what they intended to write. The Magaya brings fresh eyes and magnification. It's a quality control step that catches things the sofer might have become blind to.
The scribal script style is another variable that a lot of buyers don't understand when they're shopping. There are distinct traditions, Beit Yosef, Arizal, Sephardic, and they're not interchangeable.
Kesav Beit Yosef is the Ashkenazi standard, named after Rabbi Yosef Karo's codification in the Shulchan Aruch. Kesav Arizal is a variant associated with the Kabbalistic tradition of Rabbi Isaac Luria, and is preferred by many Hasidic communities. The Sephardic script, sometimes called Kesav Velish, has its own letter forms that differ subtly from both, and within each tradition, individual sofrim developed recognizable hands. Collectors and rabbis can sometimes identify which sofer wrote a particular set of tefillin just by looking at the letter forms, the same way art historians attribute paintings.
When you're buying tefillin, you're not just choosing a material, you're choosing a scribal lineage, essentially.
And this is where the market gets genuinely confusing for consumers. You can buy a pair of tefillin for $200 with perfectly valid scrolls in Kesav Beit Yosef written by a competent but not famous sofer using Dekat Batim. Or you can spend $3,000 on Gaso Batim with scrolls by a renowned sofer in Kesav Erezal with every kumra, every stringency observed. Both pairs are kosher. Both fulfill the mitzvah. But the market has created a status hierarchy around these differences that has very little to do with halachic validity and a lot to do with signaling.
What's a chumra? For listeners who haven't encountered the term.
A kumra is a stringency, going beyond the baseline halachic requirement. The baseline requirement for tefillin scrolls is that the letters be formed correctly and the parchment be properly prepared. A chumra might be using parchment from a specific part of the animal hide, or writing with a specific type of quill, or observing additional ritual immersions before writing. Some of these stringencies have ancient roots. Some of them were essentially invented by the certification industry to create premium product tiers. And there's an active debate in Orthodox communities about which chumrot are meaningful and which are just marketing.
How would someone even tell the difference between a meaningful stringency and a marketing one?
It's difficult, and that's part of the problem. Take the requirement that the parchment for tefillin scrolls comes specifically from the neck hide of the animal. This is a kumra that appears in some later commentaries but isn't in the Talmud. Is it a meaningful enhancement of the mitzvah? Or is it a way to justify charging more for parchment that comes from a smaller, more labor-intensive section of the hide? Reasonable people disagree. But once a chumra becomes widespread in a particular community, there's social pressure to adopt it regardless of its origins, because not doing so implies you're less observant.
This reminds me of the 2023 scandal in Jerusalem. A major tefillin manufacturer was caught using machine-printed scrolls and passing them off as handwritten. The ink didn't match carbon-based standards. It turned out to be a synthetic pigment that mimicked the look of lamp black but failed chemical testing.
That case was a watershed moment. The manufacturer had been supplying what they claimed were Mahadran tefillin to distributors across Israel and the United States. The fraud was discovered because a Magaya noticed that the letters looked too perfect. The slight variations you get with a handheld quill weren't there. They sent samples for spectroscopy and found the ink was a modern synthetic formulation. Hundreds of sets of tefillin had to be recalled. People who had paid thousands of dollars for what they thought were handwritten scrolls by a respected sofer had been using machine-printed copies.
This gets at something uncomfortable. If a trained Magaya had to use spectroscopy to catch the fraud, what chance does an ordinary buyer have?
And that's the fundamental asymmetry in this market. The seller knows exactly what they're selling. The buyer is operating entirely on trust. You can't verify the scrolls yourself. You need a magnifying glass and years of training to assess letter quality. You can't verify the leather's provenance. You're relying on a chain of certification that goes from the slaughterhouse to the tannery, to the batim maker, to the sofer, to the majaya, to the retailer. And at each link in that chain, there's an incentive to cut corners.
Which is presumably why we're now seeing technology enter the picture.
This is why several startups are now working on blockchain verification for scribal provenance. The idea is that each set of tefillin would have a digital certificate tracking every step of production. Which animal the hide came from, which tannery processed it, which batim maker constructed the boxes, which sofer wrote the scrolls, which Magaya certified them. The certificate would be cryptographically signed at each stage, creating an immutable record.
Blockchain for tefillin. We really have reached peak certification.
And I'm torn on whether this is a good thing. On one hand, fraud in the tefillin market is a real problem, and better verification would protect consumers. On the other hand, it further entrenches the idea that tefillin are a premium product to be optimized rather than a ritual object to be used. There's something uncomfortable about applying supply chain logistics software to a practice that's been essentially unchanged for two millennia.
The practice has changed. That's what the Qumran evidence shows. The materials have shifted. The certification apparatus is entirely modern. Even the script styles we consider traditional, Kesav by Yosef, Kesav Arizal, are products of specific historical moments. Kesav by Yosef was standardized in the 16th century. Kesav Arizal emerged in the 17th. These are traditions, but they're not ancient in the way people assume.
And I think this is the most important takeaway from the archaeological evidence. When people say they want authentic tefillin, they're usually imagining an unbroken chain of identical practice stretching back to Sinai. But the physical evidence tells a different story, a story of adaptation, of craftspeople making practical choices based on available materials, of regional variation, of slow evolution. The Qumran tefillin don't look exactly like modern tefillin. The boxes are shaped differently. The script is earlier. The leather preparation methods were different. They're recognizably the same ritual object, but they're not identical.
If someone is shopping for tefillin today, and they want to make an informed decision, what should they actually prioritize?
The single most important factor is scribal quality. A $200 set with properly written scrolls is more valid, halachically and functionally, than a $2,000 set with beautiful gesso batim but rushed or mediocre scribal work. The batim are a container. The scrolls are the thing itself. If you have a limited budget, put your money into the scrolls and get simpler batim. You can upgrade the batim later.
How does someone evaluate scribal quality if they're not a trained sofer?
You can't directly, which is why reputation matters so much. Buy from an established retailer who works with known sofrim. Ask who wrote the scrolls. A reputable seller will tell you the sofer's name. Ask which Majaya checked them. If the seller can't or won't give you that information, walk away. Also, look at the script style. Kesav Beit Yosef versus Kesav Arizal versus Sephardic. These are the real differentiators in terms of what you're getting, not the animal species the leather came from. Match the script to your community's tradition. That's a meaningful choice. Goat versus calf is mostly not.
The leather grade, Gasser versus Dakot versus Peshutim, how much does that actually matter?
It matters for durability. Gesso batim will last decades, potentially a lifetime, if properly cared for. Dakot might need replacement after 10 or 15 years of daily use. Peshutim will show wear within a few years. But none of this affects the halachic validity of the tefillin. It's purely a longevity and aesthetics question. If you're buying tefillin for a bar mitzvah boy who's going to outgrow them physically within a few years, Dakot are perfectly fine. If you're an adult buying what you hope will be your lifetime pair, Gesso makes sense if you can afford them.
To return to the original question, Daniel's theory that goat leather was historically authentic, the evidence says otherwise. Calf skin and sheepskin are what the archaeological record shows. And if you're choosing materials today, calfskin gesot is the premium option not because of ancient precedent, but because of material properties. Goat leather is perfectly kosher but harder to find in high grades because the hide is thinner and less suited to the compression process.
The scribal process, 8 to 12 hours per set for an experienced sofer, 3 to 4 sets per month, 1200 letters across 4 passages, each letter formed with a quill using carbon-based ink that the sofer mixes and adjusts by hand. That's the bottleneck. That's where the real value is, not in the animal the leather came from.
There's one more angle I want to explore before we wrap up. As synthetic leathers improve, there's an emerging halachic debate about whether kosher-certified vegan tefillin could be possible. The traditional requirement is that the batim be made from the hide of a kosher animal. But what if you could produce a material that's chemically and structurally identical to calfskin, but grown from cells in a lab?
This is a fascinating question, and it's already being discussed in halachic circles. Lab-grown meat has been debated extensively, whether it's kosher, whether it's pareve or flishig. Lab-grown leather raises similar questions. If the cells originated from a kosher animal, does the resulting material have the status of animal hide? If no animal was slaughtered, is it even subject to the laws of kosher slaughter? There's no consensus yet, but I expect we'll see a major responsum on this within the next decade. The technology is moving faster than the halachic process.
Which would create an interesting inversion. Right now, the premium tier is defined by how closely the product adheres to traditional methods. But if lab-grown leather becomes available and is deemed kosher, you could have a situation where the most consistent, most durable, most precisely engineered tefillin are also the most technologically innovative. The market might have to completely rethink what Mihadron means.
That's the recurring theme in any deep look at Tefillin. The tension between material tradition and technological progress isn't new. It's been there since the Qumran period. The materials have always been adapted to what's available and what works. The idea of a frozen, unchanging tradition is itself a modern invention. And I think if you told a sofer from the 1st century BCE that in 2,000 years people would be arguing about whether goat leather was the authentic choice, he'd probably laugh and tell you to use whatever keeps the scrolls dry.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In
the 1930s, a British zoologist working in Guyana mistakenly classified the axolotl as a species of aquatic lizard capable of regenerating not just limbs, but entire organ systems, including its heart and brain. This classification stood for nearly a decade before a German herpetologist corrected it in 1939, noting that axolotls are salamanders, not lizards, and while their regenerative abilities are remarkable, they cannot regenerate a brain. The original paper, however, had already been cited in 17 other studies.
Yeah, right. The thing about this episode that sticks with me is how much of the Tefillin market runs on stories people tell themselves about authenticity. Goat leather feels ancient because goats feel biblical. But the physical evidence doesn't care about vibes. Calfskin was the choice 2,000 years ago, and it's still the choice today, and for the same reason, it works better.
The scrolls inside are what actually matter. Everything else is a container. An expensive, carefully crafted, tradition-laden container, but still a container. If you're shopping for Tefillin, focus on the scribe, not the species.
This has been My Weird Prompts, with me, Korn.
Me, Herman Poppleberry. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show.
Find more at myweirdprompts.com.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.